Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready?
Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week, we talked about the sort of doldrums and empty time immediately after the Australian Open. And this week, we're going to be talking through the updates on the tour from the last 2 weeks and the six different tournaments that have been going on. So jumping right into it, Rotterdam, what did you think of this tournament overall, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we had something big, Sinner moving up to number three. You kind of called it, too, the last episode. You said, hey, if this happens, if he wins Rotterdam, he will jump to the number three. I didn't really think he would win it. I know he's been on a hot streak, but I just thought, okay, like he's got to lose at some point. So that's just kind of my biggest takeaway from the tournament. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of doing what Alcaraz did at the beginning of last year, where he's just starting off the year. I mean, obviously Alcaraz didn't play in the Australian Open last year, but in his return from his injury, he was just seemed almost unbeatable. I mean, I know he lost to Norrie and whatever that final was last year in the beginning, but Sinner right now just looks unbeatable. It's just hard to see any flaws with his game. So I think we'll see as people play him more and more, people will adjust to him. We'll see strategy changes and it'll expose flaws in his game. But right now he looks pretty incredible.
Yeah, he is hot right now. It's pretty funny because, you know, like exactly what you said about Alcaraz, we kind of saw the same thing. And now we're seeing it with Sinner. People are talking about, oh, is he better than Alcaraz? He's kind of just getting all that hype around himself now. And it'll be curious to see if he lives up to it, if he continues on, or if he just kind of drops off.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've talked about that return to the mean concept. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you're saying. Like, we're going to see him kind of take a step back at some point. But the question is where that step back is going to be too.
Yeah, because remember people were saying, oh, the next big three, Rune, Alcaraz, and Sinner. So like now people just want to talk about something and like he's giving them a perfect reason too.
Yeah. I mean, and Alcaraz and Sinner have delivered to an extent. I mean, Alcaraz, two grand slams, Sinner has one now. So obviously saying they're like the big three is a pretty massive stretch, but at least they're now, those two guys are now grand slam winners. So that's a pretty small club of people that they're in.
Right. And I think right now, Sinner just kind of gives tennis fans hope. Like we've just been looking for kind of that neck, someone to fill the void of the big three. And when you see a player like Sinner and how well he's been playing, people just kind of gravitate towards him and just kind of blow things out of proportion.
I mean, the same thing happened with Alcaraz last year. Like,
Yeah.
He was just so dominant early in the year. And everyone was like, oh my God, this guy is like the messiah of tennis.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of went from like, oh, this guy's going to win 15 grand slams. Oh, he'll win 10. And now, he'll win a few grand slams.
Yeah,
for sure.
But speaking of that last guy in the big three, or the new big three, Runa didn't have a great tournament, lost pretty early to Shevchenko.
Yeah, Shevchenko is kind of coming onto my radar, and I do like him. He plays with so much passion. He's a very, it reminds me of Runa, where he plays with like all that emotion. You know, he'll visibly show his distress, he'll show his happiness. He's a roller coaster player. Just kind of one thing I noticed during the match, or one thing I saw during the match was Shevchenko was serving and he was on his first serve. And right when he tosses the ball up, the loudspeakers just start blasting music. And he obviously messes up his serve. He puts it right in the net. And then he just kind of like puts his palms up, walks up to the umpire like, yo, what just happened?
You've got to call something there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, come on, let. No let. And the umpire wasn't going to give him a let. He's like, yeah, sorry. Like that happened. And then Rune actually stepped up and he said, hey, give him his first serve. So that's a class act by Rune. I feel like he's maturing so much since when we saw him, you know, taking strategic bathroom breaks and like maybe not being the best ethically.
Yeah, against like Rude.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Man, I like to see that Scandinavian rivalry continue though. Like I hope that just tension brews.
Yeah. But then after the loss and kind of in this time period, he also got rid of his coach, which we also kind of foreshadowed a little bit. I mean, we were joking when we said that originally, but now it became reality and Becker is out and Mortaglu is back in.
I think being a coach for Holger Rune has the least amount of job security as anything else in the world.
Yeah, every other tennis player, it's like you hire a coach, you keep him for like at least a year.
Yeah.
Rune, well, it's like hire the guy, month later, nah, it's not working. It's like you haven't even implemented any of the stuff
suggested
yet. You've played like one match with my suggestions. You lost and you're like, nope, your suggestions don't work.
No, exactly. I think you need to actually buy into the process and give it time, like wait for it to pan out. You know, I guess Rune, he's getting to the point where he's like, hey, I'm not seeing results. You're gone.
Yeah, I think it just makes it much more of like almost luck where you don't really know whether you're playing better because of your coach or just because like you happen to be feeling better that day.
Yeah, I also wonder if it's kind of the coach not really getting along with Rune. Like if they're just not really jiving, you know, if he's used to someone who will coddle him, kind of tell him like, oh no, you do no wrong, versus a coach where they're going to be more strict and more kind of on your ass. And he just hasn't really found that yet. So
yeah, this seems ridiculous to me.
Well, it's kind of crazy that Patrick's coming back to him.
Yeah, but I think it's because that's the last time he had a stable coach and he was on the rise consistently while Patrick was his coach.
Right. No, I see why he would want to go back to Patrick, but why would Patrick take him back? He's just going to get fired in a couple months.
I mean, I guess because he's like an elite level player.
I guess it's a mutually beneficial relationship there. All right. What else in Rotterdam?
Deminar made a run into the final. Ooh. Pretty impressive from him. Got revenge against Rublev for that loss he had against him in the Australian Open. And honestly, Deminar's been kind of one of the best in the world this year. In like the year-to-date rankings, like just considering the 2024 tournaments, he's actually top five in the world. Really just been consistently good throughout these tournaments. Obviously, this week didn't have a great tournament with that early loss to Mickelson, which we'll get into later. But overall, has had a pretty solid year so far.
Yeah, I wonder if we're seeing kind of a like the best of Deminar.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's still relatively young. Like, he's 25, I want to say. Which, like, it's weird because you look at these tennis players, and because they come onto the scene at, like, 17, I think you see with a lot of professional athletes where there's no college stage. Mm-hmm. Like, the same thing with soccer. I remember 5 years ago, you would look at someone like Messi, and you're like, this dude has been around forever.
Yeah.
And he was still only, like, 29, 30. And you're like, how is this dude still in his 20s? But I think it's the same thing with Deminar here. Like, he's been on the tour for a long time since he was like 16, 17. Now he's 25 and he's really playing at maybe his peak level. And it seems like he's almost like older, a veteran of the tour, but he's still a young dude, like physically.
Yeah, kind of like what you said about, oh, this guy's a veteran on the tour now, because I think now we're starting to see more of an evolution of him. Like, he's no longer that, oh, wow, who's that kid, that scrappy kid who's getting every ball? Now he's an established player. He's someone that you see in a draw where it's like, oh, damn, I have to play Deminar. Like, I can't take this match easily. Like, he's now an established top 15 player.
Yeah. I mean, like, last year, a couple of years ago, you can't disregard him in your draw, but you also, he's beatable. Versus now it's like, okay, he's like a legit top 10, top 15 guy, where he can beat pretty much anybody in the world.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a comp, and to me, Shelton is coming to mind as like the early stages of Deminar, right? Like someone who had the ability to beat top talent but wasn't consistent.
Yeah, like,
I think Shelton.
Yeah. We'll have to see how Shelton develops. Yeah.
Yeah, but can you think of maybe another comp to Deminar or no?
Umber, maybe, if Umber can consistently stay at this level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because Umber obviously he's a guy that's been around for a while and I think has like five titles or something, but has never really been a consistently top guy.
Yeah, no, that's a good comp too.
Let's hop into the next tournament, Del Rey. So obviously you talked about this is like your home tournament. Actually, four Americans in the semifinals. So it was Taylor Fritz, Marcos Giron, Tommy Paul, and Francis Tiafoe. And just like in Dallas, Giron making a run here. I guess he just plays well on home soil.
Yeah,
and I say that also because he went to Los Cabos and got decimated by Rude 6-1, 6-0. So pretty intense loss there. But this was a great run for him, and I think just a positive sign for his career overall.
Yeah, I think next time I see a tournament in the U.S. that is in ATP 500 or less, I might throw some money on Giron making a big run.
Yeah,
just I gotta watch sleeper. Out for that. Yeah, sleeper.
And then Tiafoe, I mean, I think he at least played up to like his standard, making it to the semis. Like, he's hoping for a win. And I think if he was playing like he did when he made the US Open semifinal, then he probably should have won the tournament. But he hasn't been playing like that recently. He's had a lot more kind of disappointments, to be honest. And I think making the semis is at least like a step in the right direction.
Right. So I know I ask you this a lot on these episodes, but do you think Tiafoe leaves this tournament with his head high saying, oh, I made it to the semis. Nice. Or is
I'm going
to
answer
like-
the same way I tend to answer these questions, which is that I think Tiafoe is disappointed. But I think as a fan of Tiafoe, you're like, I'm not super bummed about that because he performed better than he has been recently and about as well as his ranking and his seeding sort of predicted.
Yeah. All right. So this is on par with him. Like, he's expected to make the semis.
It's like the same thing with a Taylor Fritz making the quarterfinals.
Anything less than the semis
in Australia for him, he's disappointed. He's like, I was trying to win the tournament or at least like make the final. I think he would have considered a success at the Australian Open. Yeah. But as a fan, you're like, I mean, dude, you made the top eight and that's about what you can expect considering you played against Djokovic.
Right. It's interesting to see Tiafoe and Tommy Paul play too, because those are two American guys that I feel like kind of had the same personality where they're more of on the laid back side, like just enjoying their time on tour. Obviously they're very competitive and want to win, but I feel like both of them would have been happy for the other, if that makes sense. Like, I think Tiafoe losing to Tommy Paul, I think he's like, all right, well, if I'm going to lose to someone, I'm glad it's Tommy Paul. And I think vice versa too.
But yeah, then let's hop into this final. So it was Taylor Fritz versus Tommy Paul.
Yeah, you got some typical Florida rain. So the court just got drained out on Sunday, and they ended up playing the final on Monday, which I wonder if that impacted Tommy Paul, because you would have thought he would have given a better performance. He lost, what, like 6-2, 6-3?
He had won, what, like 8 straight matches or something going into that?
Yeah, and then the week before.
Yeah. And then loses. Wasn't like crazy dominant, but like it was definitely not
all right. Well,
close.
Let me ask you this. So do you think, obviously Taylor Fritz is the better player, do you think that it was expected that Tommy Paul loses? Like, what were your thoughts when he lost? Like, oh, okay, he lost to Fritz. Fritz is significantly better. Or were you thinking, oh, he could actually win?
Paul had, I think, more momentum. But like you said, I think Fritz is the better player right now. So I did expect Fritz to win, but I would have thought it would be closer, maybe a tie break, maybe a third set, something like that. I think 6-2, 6-3, or I don't remember what the exact score was. It wasn't as close as you were kind of expecting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I also thought this was going to be like an Instagrammable final because they're both dating influence. They both have influencer girlfriends. And I don't think
classic American
Pangela- classic America, right? So yeah, I thought they were gonna make a big deal out of it. Oh, Delray Beach, Paige Lorenz, Morgan, I don't even know Taylor Fritz's Morgan something. They're both there, but I don't think it was like that big of a deal.
I'll be honest, I don't really know. I don't really know who they are super well, but yeah. Like in my mind, they're the same person.
Oh, Pretty and Blonde?
I just think of a blonde chick. I'm like, that's who they're dating.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, we don't need to get too much into who they're dating, but next tournament. Next tournament.
All righty. Buenos Aires. So,
Buenos Aires. Come on. You said it with the good accent before.
Buenos Aires.
Yeah. Si.
Yeah. The big headline from this tournament was Jarry beating Alcaraz in that semifinal.
Let's go.
Yes. Love it. You want to talk about the Jarry train and the win here?
Yes, chugging along. Choo-choo. Dude, he kind of just outmaneuvered Alcaraz on clay because, all right, we can both agree that clay is Alcaraz's best surface, right? So you would think that he was just moving all over, but Jarry just utilized the serve and volley so much. And even if he wasn't winning direct points off of his volleys, he was still putting Alcaraz in the position where he can finish him off with easy points. So like Alcaraz had no problem running down all those volleys or running down short balls, but then he was so out of position, Jarry was just kind of sticking it to him. And you could kind of tell that the fans were very, very behind Alcaraz. So I give Jari props for that, because it's kind of hard to root against the pretty rowdy Spanish crowd rooting for Alcaraz.
Yeah, I mean, isn't Jari closer to the home player there, though? Because
he is, but he's not as likable as a player, you know? Like, you
I mean, I think Alcaraz is just more popular overall. Yeah,
exactly. That's kind of what I meant.
Number one in the world, but
that's what I meant. You're going to have more people gravitate towards Alcaraz than Jari.
I do think it's kind of funny, though, like you said, though, that Alcaraz, his best surface probably is clay, mm-hmm. and yet he's won a Grand Slam on hard court and on grass, not on clay. So kind of interesting to think about. But
yeah, one more thing about the fans. You know how they always want a match to go three sets? So you hear it even more when Jari's up in the second set. Like, obviously, the fans want to see another set. They don't want to go home early, and they want Alcaraz. So that's just another layer on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. Like, when I was at the U.S. Open,
yeah,
there were some matches when it was getting real late at night, and there'd be, like, another match to come, and you're like, I want to watch that match. Mm. I don't really want to watch this match. And so there was a point where I was watching this women's match. I don't remember exactly who was playing, but I was rooting for one of the two players initially. And after they lost the first set, I started rooting for the other person because I didn't want it to go three. And then the person that I initially was rooting for came back and won.
Oh, jeez.
I was like, yeah, well, I'm kind of glad they won, but I also didn't want to have to wait this long.
I remember you were there late, huh?
Yeah. There were some pretty intense days at that US Open.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on Alcaraz right now then?
Like I've said, he doesn't have that unbeatable look like he did at the beginning of last year and the unbeatable feeling that Sinner has right now.
I think a lot of his play style is the, like, he's able to create offense out of defense. And I think right now, I don't know if it's his agility or coaching or what, but I feel like it's not as new. On another note, he is looking ripped. He's tan. He's clearly been playing outside. He looked like a grown ass man out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, maybe it's slowing him down.
Yeah. Maybe. No. Maybe that's what it is. But then the winner of the tournament was Diaz Acosta, and kind of like has been happening a few times this year, not a big name player. And it seems like we've been having more and more of those. Diaz Acosta, Dardari, and then this guy Tabilo in Auckland earlier this year. Like, top guys aren't completely dominating the smaller tournaments like used to happen kind of in the big three era, where you would see Murray, you would see Djokovic, you would see Nadal, you would see Federer, you would see Wawrinka, you would see Ferrer. Those were the guys winning the tournaments. It wasn't like you were seeing these qualifiers or guys that were coming out of nowhere to win these tournaments. It was really just the top guys dominating.
Yeah, this is a weird time in tennis. It's a very like transitional period. I feel like we've said this enough, but the gates are wide open. It's anyone's match. There's really no solid dominant player, especially in these smaller tournaments too, because it's very spread out. There's like two or three tournaments going on at once too, so that's even more opportunity for a low ranked player to just kind of take advantage of the opportunity.
100%.
Where were these guys though during the next gen finals? Because a lot of them are young. I mean I think
there was a lot of these guys like weren't even so ranked high enough to be there.
So recent on the scene. Yeah. Huh.
Exactly.
All right, well, I guess we could continue this conversation into Qatar.
Doha. Oh, 100%. Yeah, speaking of another young guy, like the story of the tournament there is obviously Jakob Mensik, who is the youngest guy to be a top five opponent since Alcaraz.
Yeah, so he beat Tsitsipas in the 2021 U.S. Open when Tsitsipas was ranked number three.
Yes, I mean, going back to Mensik, though, he beat Murray in that second round, and it was really a tough match because Murray seemed like he had a lot of chances to get the win. And I'll get a little bit more into it later because it was my match of the week. But after seeing what Mensik did in the next round, beating Rublev and then beating Monfils and putting himself into the final, Murray's fight kind of looks a lot better because obviously Mensik is the finalist now.
Yeah, I'm sure Andy Murray's sitting on the couch watching these matches, rooting for Mensik.
Yeah, but he's also like, God damn it, I was so close.
Yeah. Well, think about it. If you would, yeah, like remember that point? Or I guess we can get into it later, but think about it. Like if Andy Murray would have won that match, we would have no clue who Mensik is right now. He would not be the talk of the town.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Crazy.
Just beating like one big guy, or like you can just emerge onto the scene out of nowhere, really.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully Mensik becomes a household name here in the next couple of years. Like him. He's a big guy. He's 6'3". He's one of the, you know, I like to gravitate towards the bigger players.
Just like the height.
I don't like the vertically challenged players. I don't like them running around.
Yeah,
there.
You're just not a fan of someone like Schwarzman. No. You're just like, this guy is too short.
A lot of the French players too, like Luca Van Ash. Too short for me.
God damn. Sizest.
Yeah. Yes.
But
wait, one more thing I gotta say about Mensik. He's got style too. He rocks the Curios, the tank top with the shirt, the compression shirt underneath. It's a good look. I don't know. It's different. It's unique for tennis. Like, you don't see that often.
Definitely a bold look. I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah. Bold is good. All right. Now we can move on. Well, he's in the final tomorrow versus Hachinov.
Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Cruising. Yeah, I know. All right.
Yeah. So Los Cabos, couple headlines here. Mickelson upset Deminar. I know I said Deminar was doing real well. Obviously, this one didn't go great for him, but it shows that Mickelson at least is on a positive trend still. Because obviously last year he was like the fastest rising guy pretty much in the top 100, went up a crazy amount of spots, essentially started his professional career halfway through the year and ended inside the top 100, which is just insane. But now beating a guy like Deminar, who's appearing to be reaching his peak in his career and a top 10 guy, and now Mickelson beats him, just shows that Mickelson's still on that positive trend, which is great to see.
Yeah, this has got to be Mickelson's biggest win of his career, no?
I believe so, yeah.
But yeah, and then he should have won against Jordan Thompson too. He was up.
Well, he dominated that first set. I think he won the first set like 6-0.
Yeah, he did. He did, and he ended up losing the match, which is crazy.
It's just crazy when you see matches where people like will split sets and each of the sets were just completely dominated. You're like, what happened?
Yeah. You got to think at the, like when it gets towards the end of the set and you're down, you know, 4-0, you're like, all right, let's just get this over with. Get on to the next.
Just pull a Kyrgios and walk off the court in the middle of the point.
Yeah. I saw a funny video. Did he do that?
He like went back to return a serve and just like the guy served it and he just walked away.
Yeah. There, Tennis TV posted a video of Davidovich Fokina basically doing the same thing. Like, the serve came in. He obviously didn't even try. Just kind of like popped it up as he was walking off the court. And then he got a point penalty or like a, what's the penalty for that? They're like, oh, not your best effort. You know, it's so funny.
Yeah, I know.
That they could do.
They're like, you just suck. Either you suck or you're not trying.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, yeah, come on. The fans paid good money. You try.
But yeah, it's like unsportsmanlike conduct, essentially.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it. And he's like, no, like, you can't do that. You have to give me a warning first. He's like, no, I don't.
Yeah, it's like, it's at my discretion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Los Cabos, we got a 4-versus-2 matchup between Ruud and Tsitsipas, and then a 1-versus-8 with Zverev and Thompson. In this tournament, we're actually kind of seeing more of a normal kind of top seeds in the last couple rounds, so... Mm-hmm. I think there's a positive to that.
Yeah, I'm so conflicted here because I love Ruud and I want him to beat Tsitsipas, but I also want to see a Tsitsipas Zverev final just because I feel like those guys were the ones who came up as the next gen and there is a rivalry there. And they're both kind of similar in the way they act too, just kind of like don't have the best reputation on tour, like kind of shady guys, shady players. And I would love to see a final with them.
Conflicted between the rivalry pick versus the favorite player pick.
Yes. But hey, at least on the bright side, I'll be happy with either result with the Ruud Tsitsipas match. Well, that's if Zverev beats Thompson, though, assuming he does.
Yeah, if Tsitsipas wins and Thompson wins, you're gonna be
then I'm pissed.
Yeah, exactly.
How about those courts on there though? Oh, yeah, it's like brown and blue.
An odd combo.
Yeah. But I wonder if that's one of the best tournaments for the players to kind of just like enjoy. Like, come on, if you lose, you're chilling in Mexico.
Yeah, I feel like you could say that about a lot of places, probably.
Yeah, the life like of a tennis player.
Delray Beach, I mean, you lose, you're chilling in Florida.
Yeah, that's true. When it's not torrential downpour.
You say that about like Miami Open, you go hang out in Miami after. I feel like that's just the classic, like good location you can go hang out after.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and then the last tournament is Rio, where headlines were Alcaraz having that major ankle injury. We'll see what happens in the coming tournaments, but definitely looked like a pretty aggressive injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to, you know, make light of this injury, but his opponent is actually 2-0 against him now.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, one of those, obviously the walkover. That is within the first couple points of the match too.
Yeah.
Almost as Zverev. Zverev 2.0, like you saw the injury, it looked just like it, where he was moving laterally and then rolled over his ankle. I wonder if that's a clay specific injury.
Maybe. I also wonder about, like, in a smaller tournament like this, whether mm-hmm. or not the size of the tournament plays into whether or not he withdraws there. Like, if this was the French Open, would he have played through that?
Yeah. Maybe. And so it ended up being a grade 2 lateral sprain. And the good news is he'll be back for Indian Wells, so he says. So it just sounds like a grueling rehab process and some rest.
Yeah, that's definitely a positive thing to hear.
I mean, yeah, grade 2 is not super bad, it sounds like. It's not grade 3.
I have no idea. I don't know how many grades.
How many grades? Yeah.
It could be grades? There could be 2 total grades. It could be grade 1 is okay and grade 2 is bad. I don't yeah. I'm not a doctor yeah. here, but
jeez, have you ever had an ankle injury?
No, I'm lucky with my ankles. I have pretty strong ankles, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't want to jinx him, but I feel like the ankle is a brutal one where if once you injure it, it just kind of becomes a nagging thing that lingers. I had an ankle injury when I was in, I want to say, 6th grade, and it bothered me up until college almost. Like, I would wear an ankle brace the whole time I played. And then finally a coach told me one time, like, I don't know why you wear that ankle brace, because it's just making your ankle weaker. I'm like, no, it hurts without it. He's like, yeah, because you're compressing it so much that the muscles aren't being used around it. So once he told me that, I stopped wearing the brace, and what do you know? Ankle got better.
Yeah.
You're basically just transferring all that up to your knee, all that pressure.
Interesting. Yeah. And then the last headline from these tournaments is João Fonseca upset Fields, beat him pretty handedly, 6-0, 6-4, and is actually playing for a spot in the semis right now as a no-name kind of guy, like we've talked about with some of the other guys. Maybe is he going to be the guy that makes the run this tournament? We'll see. I think he's in the third set right now, so we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, 17 years young, born in 2006. Can you believe that?
Too young.
Yeah, I know. All right,
you ready to hop into segments?
Yeah, let's do it. What is new in tennis? So mine this week, it's not really new in tennis, but I didn't bring it up when it initially happened, and I feel like it's still something notable that we didn't talk about that I feel like we could. John McEnroe kind of came under blast for admitting during a match during the Australian Open that he knew nothing about a player who happened to be Zizou Bergs. He was with Kyrgios actually announcing this match. It was against Tsitsipas, and Bergs was a lucky loser, so he just kind of snuck his way in, and he goes, tell me what you know about him, because I don't know anything. He says this to Kyrgios, and then a player actually tweeted, a player who was ranked like in the, I think, 300, said, it's insane to me that time and time again John McEnroe goes on air and just admits he has zero clue who a player is, just says to the world, hey guys, I've done zero research for my job, and I'm just going to disrespect someone who's in the top 150 in the world at a job. So I want to hear your thoughts on this, because I feel like it's John McEnroe, so it kind of gets like pushed under the rug, you know?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think, I don't know who said that tweet, but I think when you're looking at it, it's like John McEnroe does kind of get to do that, because he's maybe top one in the world at tennis announcing.
Yeah.
And so it obviously is disrespectful, because yeah, this is exactly. A guy that his job is to know about this guy, and right. He's not really doing his job if he goes on there and doesn't know about him, but he does get away with it. And it is at least interesting, and it is on brand for McEnroe to say that, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. he's not going to go on there and pretend to know who Bergs is, at least. Like, that may be even worse, to try to pretend you know who the guy is and yeah. not know anything about them. I think especially because it's live too. Like, imagine if he had tried to pretend that he knew who he was, and then he gets a question asked about him, and he's like,
I mean, I think you could just chalk this up to comedy, like McEnroe just being blunt, not really caring. He's 64 years old. He's at that age. You know how old people just don't care? You know, they'll just say whatever.
To an extent, it just doesn't.
But it reminds me, remember when we had Gil on and I asked him, oh, so like, what's the prep that goes into calling a match? And he was like, hours and hours of research, you know, like watching match highlights, reading articles, like looking into your player, because that's your job. You want to be prepared for it.
Yeah, knowing who you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, so it's just funny to hear both sides of it.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of a situation where it's like, for Gil, who's a broadcaster but isn't a famous player, it's like, yeah, he has to do all this research, and that's how he is going to essentially perform the broadcast well. Right. McEnroe can get on there and just say like what he sees and accomplish and be essentially, like Gil said, it's really about entertaining the audience during the match in between points and stuff. So McEnroe can do that even if he doesn't know who the players are.
Oh, he's the best. I love a McEnroe called match.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be hilarious to watch McEnroe come out and just commentate like two guys playing at a country club sometime, because he could do it. He'd be like, yeah, this guy in the front here in the red shirt, he clearly seems to be attacking the backhand, but can't generate enough topspin to actually come forward. It's like he can evaluate the game well enough, but doing the research is really, like this guy said, kind of a sign of respect.
Yeah.
The fact that he didn't is.
I agree. I'm kind of on the same page as you. It's just, it is objectively disrespectful, but it's John McEnroe. So what are you going to do?
Exception.
Yeah. What about you? What did you see this week in tennis?
So one thing I saw is the Netflix Slam is coming up at the beginning of March, and they put out these private hitting sessions for sale with players like Nadal and Alcaraz and other ones with guys like Fritz and Tiafoe and another one with Isner and Sam Querrey. But there were two private sessions, one with Nadal and one with Alcaraz, and they sold for $150,000. All I can say about this is just, it's just crazy.
Yo, you better know how to speak Spanish too, because I feel like you're not going to get your money's worth with these two if you can't speak Spanish.
I can't imagine you show up and it's like, imagine you don't even speak English either. You're just like, you speak like German or something, and you're like, oh, sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Yeah.
Like, nope, not like, at all.
Nein?
Yeah.
No, this is one of those. Yeah, I think whoever did buy it is hoping to parlay this into a friendship with them down the road. You know, like, obviously a very wealthy individual who could probably offer them a lot, whether it's like, hey, you want to come to my beach house? You want to come on my yacht? And just try to build that relationship. But I wonder if you're someone like Fritz or Tiafoe, what do you know? Do you remember what those prices were? Those rates?
Well, I think it was them. It was a group session for like 50,000.
Yeah. I wonder if you're offended.
Are you offended? But not even worth? When you think about it, you're like 50 grand. That's still ridiculous.
I wonder how much of that money they see. If it goes to them or probably some of it has to go
to the Netflix Slam, and then some of it goes to them.
I'm trying to think of other big players that they could have approached. Like, I'm sure Casper Ruud, actually no, because
it's about popularity.
We don't know who is in the draw, do we?
I don't know.
It's not a draw. It's not even a draw.
I haven't really been that closely following.
You're not going to watch it, Aiden?
Probably not. I think it's like an exhibition match. I don't really care.
I'm going to check it out, see what's good, because I've never watched a live Netflix sports event.
Yeah. The only other one there was, I think, was that golf one.
And I really
didn't care.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll do something with
that. I turned it on. I was like, I'm not going to watch golf, so I'm going to turn this off. Yeah. You ready for a bet of the week?
Let's do it. I am going on a pure momentum play here and going Mensik plus 195 over Khachanov in the final. I think it's just the perfect fairy tale ending here. I can't tell you strategically why I'm choosing Mensik. I can just tell you I feel it in my gut, and I think he's going to have it. Like, just
off. Talk about momentum. I mean, Mensik did beat Khachanov's countryman, Rublev, who is a higher-ranked player. So you can't count Mensik out in this match, and plus 195 is pretty good odds, I'd say.
Yeah, I feel like he's also going to have the crowd behind him. Like, he is that story player that people are rooting for, that underdog.
Yeah, and it's like Kachanov, like a good player, been around a while, but I don't think he has like a crazy fan base. Like he's not massively popular.
Yeah, pretty funny story about Mensik. So they interviewed him after he beat Rublev, and they asked him, being ranked in the top 250, you got to pick one tournament that you could play in, one ATP tournament that wasn't a challenger. And why'd you pick this one? They're like, oh, because I got a free iPhone out of it. And I just think that's so on brand with Qatar.
Yeah, I mean, definitely on brand with the mega wealthy over there. Just
oh, I know.
Giving him, be like, here's something expensive. Do you like this? Okay, good.
Yeah. All right, what about your bet of the week?
Yeah, so I'm going with Rude plus 100 over Tsitsipas. I always go for the underdog, and this one is just barely the underdog because it's got that plus mm-hmm. sign in front of it. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially like pure 50-50 odds, just like doubling your money if you win, which I think is pretty good considering this is like what feels like a very even matchup. I mean, the underdog here doesn't really feel like the underdog. And especially when you consider how Ruud has been playing, like he dominated Giron 6-1, 6-0, and then beat Borges pretty comfortably 6-3, 6-2. So pretty comfortable wins. And he's coming into this matchup against Tsitsipas. And I think it could go either way, but with plus 100 odds, I think that's a pretty good bet.
Yeah, I like that too. Obviously, the Ruud just kind of tips the scale for me, being Norwegian and being my favorite player. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm definitely going to tune into this match because just looking at it from a strategic point, though, like, do you see Ruud having any upper hands in any scenarios? For example, attacking the Tsitsipas backhand with his powerful forehand, like getting into long rallies.
I think,
like, where do you think he has?
I think both of them have weaknesses. I think both of them have strength. I think this is going to be a very even matchup. Like I said,
yeah.
I don't think there's any one thing that really stands out as he's only going to go after this. I think it's just going to be who plays better on the day.
Yeah, and another interesting, I guess, option for this would be the over 2.5 sets is plus 135.
Yeah, could also go for that.
Yeah, so plenty of options here.
Yeah, and then match of the week. I went with Murray versus Mensik. I feel like I go with Murray a lot because, like I've said, I like watching his matches. But this was just, it was a super tight match, but it was a heartbreaker for Murray. Especially after he got his first win of the year in this tournament. This match had three tiebreaks, and Murray in the first set tiebreak actually had a set point, hit a great forehand inside out up the line, and Mensik got it back, and Murray had an easy volley that he just dumped in the net, and they ended up losing the tiebreak. Second set comes in, and he wins in a tiebreak, and then in that third set, he goes down 5-2, and Mensik was actually serving for the match, and Murray then battled all the way back, won four games in a row, forced it to a tiebreak, but then lost in the tiebreak. Uh-huh. So just absolutely a heartbreak there at the end, but it was an entertaining match overall.
Yeah, that is tough, Murray. I mean, like we mentioned it before, if he doesn't dump that ball into the net, who knows if we even are talking about Mensik right now.
100%. Yeah. Maybe we don't even know who he is.
Yeah, I know.
What about you?
Yeah, my match of the week was Hurkacz losing to Griekspoor. So he lost 7-6, 6-7, 6-7. So I feel like the scoreboard just says it all. Three tiebreakers, three sets. This was a hell of a match. And little fun stat about Hurkacz. So the last five sets of tennis that he's played have been tiebreakers because the match before was a three-setter where the last two were tiebreakers. You know, clearly Hurkacz doesn't get broken.
Yeah. I mean, that bet for him being the most aces this year from the end of last year is looking pretty good so far.
Yeah. I mean, so I like this match. It was pretty entertaining one to watch, not only because it was tight with the score, but there was a lot of variety too. So there was a lot of net play, and then there was also some heavy baseline rallies. So that's always fun to watch. Then you got Hubie pumping out aces. My favorite one is down the tee where the ball just tails so far away where you can't do anything about it. It's basically impossible to return. And just another little fun thing I saw at the end of the match was, so it was a tiebreaker. And once Hubie lost, he just freaking smashed his racket on the ground, which I feel like is out of character for him. You know, he seems like such a nice temperament guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just tough to lose a match after that many games.
Yeah.
Gonna be upsetting.
All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.